Hello and welcome to another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Dr. John Kitzsteiner, a medical doctor in general practice who is also a permaculturist. I've known of John and his work for some time, both as part of the community over at the Survival Podcast forums, as well as from his very, very good permaculture blog, Temperate Climate Permaculture. You'll find a link to his blog in the show notes, but if you'd like to go there, it's simply tcpermaculture.com. During this conversation, after we cover his biography and background, we begin talking about how we can eat better and live better and do more with permaculture by making food our medicine and our medicine our food. Through this conversation, we talk about general health and how to eat, what decisions we can make to be better, to stay healthy, in ways that extend beyond just the physical of our body, but also to take care of our mind and spirit, and also about nutrient density within foods and phytonutrients, and just an easy way to decide what we'll eat. Because of that, I'm going to include links back to Arthur Haynes, Mary Johnson, and Dan Kittredge, because those conversations touch on the value of wild foods, as well as this idea of building nutrient density through living soils and making different choices and selecting foods that are nutrient dense when we go to the grocery store or the farmer's market, if that's where we're still purchasing our food. If you enjoy this show, please become a sustaining monthly member. It really helps to keep things on the air, as some of you have recently listened to, as this show comes out, as I really want to keep this show going and going and going, really for the rest of my days, and for every new permaculture practitioner who comes on the scene to be able to hear the voices and stories and ideas of so many different people who are working to build a better world. You can do so by going to www.thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. And you'll find a couple of drop-down boxes there for one-time and recurring donations. In addition to this conversation with me, Dr. Kitzsteiner is going to be a presenter at the upcoming Permaculture Voices conference. So if you're going to be going there, look him up. If this is the first time you heard about him being there and you were going, let him know you heard about it on the show. Let me know that you met him afterwards and what that experience was like, as I only know him through the ether of the internet. But anyway, here is Dr. Kitzsteiner. I'll join you again afterwards with some more thoughts and updates. Well then, John, Dr. Kitzsteiner, if you're ready, why don't you give us a little bit of your biography and background, how you came to do what you're doing, and we can take it from there.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on your show. I've been listening for a little while, so it's always fun to be a guest on somebody else's show, especially one that you listen to. But I guess if I was going to give my biography, it kind of starts off in the sprawling suburbia of South Florida. I grew up in Fort Lauderdale, and I was a kid that just loved to be outside, and I loved to read. And so I would spend a lot of time climbing in the orange trees in our backyard, playing in the canals that were across the street, catching animals. We had lots of wild ducks, all the Muscovy ducks. I had a number of those as pets for a very short term until my parents would make me get rid of them. Turtles, fish, snakes, lizards, anything I could catch and find, I would kind of take back home and make a little terrarium out of. And then I would walk over or ride my bike over to the local library and check out books on whatever it was that I was interested in or just happened to find. And oftentimes I would check out so many books that I'd have to leave my bike there and walk home and then go back and get my bike and come back for it. And then also at the same time, I would spend a lot of time drawing and sketching a lot of the animals that I would catch or find. And so I grew up with this kind of a mixture of a love of arts and science. And growing up and going through high school, I never really had any ideas about what I wanted to do when I grew up, it was always kind of a big question mark. I know I wanted to do something that seemed important and something that I cared about, but I just didn't really have any good direction. And so during my senior year of high school, I ended up getting a scholarship to go to an art school. And so I attended the Art Institute of Fort Lauderdale down in South Florida, and I got an associate's degree in graphic design. And shortly thereafter, I moved up to Kentucky to where my girlfriend, now my wife, was attending school and playing basketball. And I worked for a company for a year, and they went out of business. And so I ended up starting my own business doing graphic design for the next 5 years. Somewhere in the middle there, my wife got this just skin rash. It ended up being a contact dermatitis, or just a contact allergy. And these dermatologists told her, well, you're just going to have to learn to live with this. And I thought that was one of the most rude, uncaring things that I had ever heard. And I decided, you know, maybe going back to school and becoming a doctor might be a good idea. And at that point in my life, I had never actually known any doctors, definitely not on a personal basis. My dad is a carpenter. My mom was a stay-at-home housewife. And my dad worked for doctors, but never with doctors. And we didn't have insurance growing up, so I never even really saw a regular doctor except for when I was a young child. And so I ended up enrolling at the local college there, Western Kentucky University, and took a freshman biology course and loved it and thought, oh my goodness, what is this whole world of science that I had been missing my whole life? Because it was a different type of science. It was a much more analytical approach to science than I'd ever really experienced before, even at my high school. Also about this same time, I had started to become friends with a few farmers, a couple very traditional corn, soybean, wheat farmers, as well as a dairy farmer who kind of started giving up, realizing that the dairy industry was going to leave him behind if he didn't do something drastic. And so he did. He started a cheese making shop, which has now blossomed into this huge enterprise for him. And he's very successful making very, very good cheese. And so I got to see this contrast of farming, and I stumbled across this book at the local library, because even at that time, being very busy, I still read a lot and would go to the library and read about whatever it was I was interested in. And I came across Joel Salatin's book, You Can Farm. And the ideas in there, which were very permaculture-minded, really excited something inside me. And I didn't really know what it was at that point. And so I kind of continued to read a lot more about this alternative farming movement. And it was probably a couple years later that I came across the word permaculture. But I had seen it a few times, but it seemed like this weird kind of earth worship kind of thing. So I kind of stayed away from it for a couple of years because it just kind of seemed weird. And at that same time, I had gone back to school full time. I had kept my business going full time, so I was extremely busy. I ended up getting into medical school and going on a scholarship through the Air Force, where they paid for my medical school and I owed them time back, and ended up attending the Mayo Clinic up in Rochester, Minnesota, and just was able to devote full time back to school and was just in love with it. I really, really enjoyed medicine a lot. Went into primary care, family medicine, and ended up going back into my residency for family medicine back down in Florida. And so I traveled kind of back and forth around the kind of eastern half of the U.S. quite a bit. And this whole time that I'm doing this, I've realized a few things. One was that with my art career, I loved it, but when my hobby became my job, I kind of lost the hobby. And so it took a number of years for me to kind of really get back into any sort of art or creativity side of things. With my medicine, I realized that initially I had wanted to get away from the kind of current Western medicine mindset because of those couple of dermatologists who were just jerks to us. I thought, you know, they've all sold out to pharmaceutical, you know, companies and to big business, and maybe they don't know what they're talking about. And so I was going to become a naturopathic physician. And as I was making my way through my undergraduate degree and learning a lot more about science and understanding research, I realized there really is a lot of very good information in the alternative medicine world, but it's just lost in this forest of quacks and kind of crazy pseudo, you know, helpful science. And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to become as legitimate as possible and get a traditional medical degree, an MD, and then I would incorporate this alternative medicine into my practice, kind of really taking the best of what I was considering the best of both worlds and really do complementary alternative medicine or complementary medicine. And so when I was in medical school, I helped start the alternative medicine or complementary medicine interest group there at the Mayo Clinic. And the one faculty advisor that we had to have, he now runs the complementary and alternative medicine department at the Mayo Clinic. And so it was definitely something that was needed and something that I think is making a lot of inroads in modern medicine at this time. So really kind of wrap things up from a intro standpoint, it was during this whole time, I just kept reading more and more about alternative farming and really started to understand that permaculture was not this crazy alternative thing, but it was really a science. It was a design science. And once that took hold, once I realized what permaculture actually was, it really started to make a lot of these other endeavors that I had start to pale. I realized that permaculture really is what I wanted to be doing in a long-term future. But at that point, when I kind of decided this or realized this, I still had a lot of obligations. I was still obliged to the military. I still had this really good career that could help a lot of people as a physician. And so I spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out exactly how I was going to incorporate all these things into one kind of productive and healthy and fulfilled life. And that's kind of where I'm at right now. I don't know, that was kind of a long introduction.
It's quite all right. As I said in my end of year review for 2013, which will have been released a number of weeks before our conversation comes out, and I'll include a link back to that for the listeners if they'd like to check that, is that my background is originally in sociology and anthropology. So it's as much about collecting someone's story and understanding who they are and where they come from as it is about the rest of the conversation with permaculture. And you provide us with another clear example of how convoluted the road can be to get to permaculture.
Yes.
You have your website, Temperate Climate Permaculture, which is tcpermaculture.com, which I will say is, in my opinion, one of the better websites about permaculture because it's clear, well-organized, easy to find information. I'm sitting here making some notes as I have your site pulled up about some changes that I want to make to my own that are similar to what you have because it's just the user interface is nice.
You know, the couple of things that I really took with the permaculture, with my website, is that I guess there are multiple aspects. One, as my graphic designing background, I definitely wanted something that looked nice, looked clean, looked professional. And from my art background, I felt like I could kind of incorporate that. From my science background, I wanted something that was accessible, something that was actually going to be helpful. The reality is I started this website as a blog years ago as a way for me to organize all this information that I was finding that I wanted to reference myself in the future. And as I started, I mean, I would have so many Word documents and files and folders of PDFs of all this information. And it was just getting way too bulky. And it would take me forever to find anything that I wanted to reference for myself later on. And so I decided I'm just going to basically keep an online permaculture journal about the information that I find, the things that I find relevant to where I want to be in the future, which was going to be a temperate climate. Because so much that was out there at the time, especially when I first started this, everything was in the tropics, everything was in the subtropics, everything was in the desert, you know, greening the desert and, you know, making banana circles. And these things were fascinating, but not very applicable to where I saw myself in the future. And so part of me got very frustrated initially. And then I started getting excited, realizing, wow, you know, there's this whole area of permaculture that just doesn't have a lot of on-the-ground examples. What I didn't know at the time was that there actually were a large number of people who were doing it, but very few people were writing about it or documenting it. And in the last few years, a lot of these people have started coming out and publishing their books and getting their information and their stories out there from, you know, Wisconsin to Vermont. You know, Sepp Holzer really came up on the scene kind of around this time as well. And so, but a skill that I realized that I'm good at, while I was kind of stuck doing the military thing and moving around the world from Turkey to Portugal and not being able to practice permaculture on the large scale, I still wanted to contribute. And I realized that I was good at taking a lot of information and gleaning out the important facts and presenting it in a way that people can grab hold of and they could actually take and learn from. And so I felt like, you know, I'm not able to do anything large scale right now, but I can help. I can start providing the information that I find important on my site. And over the last few years, I've realized that there are a lot of people who were looking for the same information that I was looking for. And now I'm just helping provide that to them.
And just as a quick comment about that, it's looking at your website, there's a ton of material here. But as you say, this is something you've built and grown over years. That for someone who's just starting out, who wants to practice professional permaculture, just remember that it takes time to get this amount of information, like John has at his website, or all the episodes of the podcast, like I have at mine. They're built over years. So don't let this success of others discourage you from walking down your own path.
I completely agree with that.
You know, it took you years to find permaculture and begin walking down this road through your work as an MD, finding your own specialty, your own niche, the place that you fill. And everyone who I've talked to, it's not something where they just wake up one day and go, I'm going to do this and have success the next day.
No, you know, very few people can actually do that. You know, I've heard it multiple times in various ways, you know, but success is often spelled W-O-R-K, or there's, you know, multiple variations of how I know that there's some true story behind where that originated from. But the reality is that I spent a lot of time working on my site. When I would put my kids to bed, my wife would go to sleep and I would stay up way too late researching things because it was a passion for me. It was something I was really, really interested in and I really liked to do it. And I definitely encourage people to, you know, find that thing that you're really passionate about and see if you can find a way to build a presence or build a identity around that. And it does, it can take years before you get to the point where you feel like, yeah, I actually have this presence or I have this identity that is really of something of substance. And it's not an overnight thing. Very few people can do something overnight. It takes time for you to figure out exactly what you're good at, what your skills are, and to find your voice, especially if you're a writer, if you're a podcaster. It takes you a little while to figure out exactly, you know, to feel like, hey, I actually have got a groove now. I understand what I'm trying to do. I understand what the direction that I'm trying to go in is. But as in all things with permaculture, you have to analyze, you have to read read the lay of the land, and you have to make changes, small changes if you can, and kind of see how that takes hold on the whole system.
And the topic that I wanted to talk with you about today was about your Dr. Permaculture's Guide to Healthy Eating. Someone referred me to because I recently had a follow-up interview with Arthur Haynes about natural foods and foraging. And it's on your site index, right below that section you have about community and the idea of the myth of the perfect job. So I'll include a link to that section so people can read that as a follow-up to this little aside that we've had here so they can understand more of that idea of finding your calling and building and growing. With your work as a doctor and your interest in complementary medicine, which I have to say is something that I'm very appreciative of after many years of having doctors who were just like, well, the problem that you have is you're smoking. Quit that and you'll be fine. Oh, well, you have a problem with that. Here's a pill. Take this. You're okay. And when really, for me, it was took 10 years to receive a diagnosis for celiac disease.
Oh, yeah.
And what it's like to be kind of like pushed through a system without someone who's understanding or caring about their patients. It took a long time before I found someone who had that kind of interest in me as a person and making sure that, you know, well, if your stress levels are lower, you can make better decisions about how you eat, how you take care of yourself. And that's just my experience, is having someone who cares about me as a patient allows me to live a better life and make better medical decisions and choices for my health. And with your work as a doctor, what role does taking care of ourselves have in that process? You know, what is healthy eating like? What does that mean in the context of someone who is practicing permaculture, both within their lifestyle choices within their garden?
I'll back you up a little bit there and just say, I am humbled and shocked sometimes about how many patients of mine tell me that, Dr. K, you're one of the only doctors I've ever met that seems to care. You're, you know, one of the best doctors I've had because you seem to just listen and take the time. And I'm honored when they say that. I truly am. But I'm also at the same time just so disappointed and shocked to hear that, because I don't feel like I'm not a Mother Teresa. You know, I don't have this infinite level of compassion for people more than anybody else. But I do think that I look at my patients, and this is probably part of how I got into medicine in the first place, was that I was so frustrated with that same type of doctor who didn't seem to care, that I really see every single one of my patients as my wife, or as my son, or as my daughter, or as my father, or as my grandfather, that going to the doctor is a big deal for them. You know, it's cut and dry for me. That's what I do every single day. You know, 18, 20 times a day, I see a new person, sometimes less, sometimes more. But to that person, going to the doctor may be one of the bigger things that they do in the month, in the year. Their health that is not good may be the thing that's been consuming their life for the last year or more, or 10 years in your case. And it's a big deal. And if I don't understand that from their perspective, I'm not going to be a good doctor. And I'm not really going to take it as serious as I should. And when we are not healthy, nothing else seems to matter. You know, that's one of the reasons I almost went into dermatology, not just because my wife had this rash and that got me interested in it in the first place. But when you've got something on the outside of your body that is itching or scratching or causing you to have to wear long sleeve shirts in the middle of the summer because you don't want to show your skin, it has a big impact on us psychologically. And one of the things that I was taught, and I was so thankful for this exposure when I was in medical school, was the Mayo Clinic pushes this concept of the bio, psycho, social, spiritual model of healthcare, in that we're not just this clump of molecules walking around, but we are composed of our biology, yes, but a psychology. You know, we have a mind, we have thoughts, we have feelings and emotions. Social, we have this interconnectedness with other people, with our family members, with our spouses, with our children, or poor relationships, and that influences our health. And spiritually, we truly are not just here, we live, we die. We do have another essence inside of us, that, you know, a soul, a spirit. And when we do not consider all four of those aspects together as a whole, we truly cannot be healthy. We truly cannot, as a practitioner, as a physician, take care of our patients in a way that is complete and whole, unless we consider that patient as a whole person. And so it's not just about the biology, it's about a lot of other things. And when, as you said, you know, it took you 10 years to get a diagnosis of celiac. I've diagnosed more than a couple patients with celiac disease that, you know, it just boggles my mind that people have not even thought about this, because I feel like they just don't listen. You know, I think this is the biggest complaint that patients have when they go see their doctor, is that they just don't listen. Now, when I look at this from our personal health, from our personal well-being, I would say that people have a very hard time listening to themselves. They are focusing on the biology. They say, I don't feel good. Well, it must be something medically. And they are not looking at themselves as a whole person. They're not taking into account their psychological well-being, their social well-being, and their spiritual well-being. And we obviously can get too focused on one aspect more than the other, but we really have to look at all four of those aspects to be in good health. A lot of times, if we fix one aspect, you know, let's say a person's coming in when they have poor sleep. Well, it could be poor sleep. It could be, you know, there are a lot of different lifestyle issues, but it could be depression. It could be other things that are bogging their mind. And the answer is not, hey, here's a pill. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it does need to be that. But a lot of times it doesn't. A lot of times it has to do with identifying what is actually the cause. What is the root of this? And this is where I got so excited about permaculture, because I really feel that permaculture is the key to health across the board. we have the ability to, as Hippocrates said, make our food our medicine and our medicine our food. When we are not putting in the best fuel to our body, we really, really are going to put ourselves at a massive disadvantage that ends up affecting all of these other aspects of our lives. For you, celiac disease, or for anybody else with these, maybe a food allergy or some other sort of chronic medical condition, to say that that's not going to affect you psychologically when you're dealing with something every single day, you know, day in, day out, is ridiculous. And for, I've seen so many people that come in and they've got a medical condition and they are on psychological medications, psychotropic medications that I don't feel like they even need to be on if we can just fix this medical issue. But people don't want to take the time to listen and dig deep and get to the root of the problem. So when I wrote this article, there are these series of articles on, you know, Dr. Permaculture's Guide to Healthy Eating. My idea was to really look at this one aspect, I guess the biologic aspect, and see how it kind of affects the other parts of our lives.
One of the things, though, that you say there before we move into discussing those articles that you wrote, and that I know that I don't have this right, but the bio, psycho, social, spiritual model of medicine, it's like with celiac disease. Until recently, it was very difficult to go out to eat with friends. And because of my dietary issues, how that changed my ability to socialize with other people and the impact that had on me to go out to dinner and go, well, Scott, what are you going to get? Well, they don't have anything that I can eat here. I'm just going to have a glass of water. Or going to a restaurant that can serve gluten-free food and trying to explain that I'm on a medically necessary gluten-free diet and having them appropriately take care of me as a customer and serve me food that isn't going to make me sick. Or going to a place where I order a salad and ask for no croutons and realize when it gets there that it looks like my salad was made and then they pick the croutons off.
Yeah.
And, you know, having to send that back. Or like a menu not listing all the ingredients that are on something. So not saying, well, no croutons on the salad because they're not listed on it, and then receiving it. And then I feel like a jerk when I tell them, no, I'm sorry, I have to get a new one.
Yeah.
I only tell this story because of thinking about the way that these different pieces come together and how handling these situations can have such an impact on someone.
Which, you know, goes back to, again, and this is not necessarily a permaculture issue, although it dovetails with permaculture, the fact that I really feel like we have become so disconnected with our food, growing it and raising it ourselves, that we end up at the mercy of, you know, restaurateurs or other people that are making our food or whatever the packaging says that is in there. And the, you know, and I actually don't even think I put this in my article, but the biggest thing that I wish people would do is just start making their food, making their meals themselves. Then they know, first of all, exactly what's in it. They will get so much more connected to their food source. They'll be way more motivated to have good, fresh ingredients. They'll be way more motivated to grow their own, or at least to support people in their local area that are growing their own in a way that they are feel is morally, ethically in line with their kind of their worldview. And I think that especially for people that are in your situation, but in situations that are similar, people that have these food issues or for health issues, diabetes is a big thing. The food sensitivities, which just seem to be blossoming way out of control in comparison to where they used to be 50 to 100 years ago. When we get back to raising and making our own food, we end up mitigating a lot of those problems.
One of the things that you said there, though, about connecting with food is in my studies of environmental education and about caring about the environment is that you have to be connected with something and be aware of it in order to want to care about it, to know enough about it and be connected enough to it to want to take care of whatever it is that you're doing, be that, you know, your food or your water or any other personal concern that you might have. So I can see how that reconnection to one's diet and what they're eating could lead you down.
Yeah, no, I don't mean to interrupt, but I think this is it's such a important point that throughout all of humanity, until recently. And if you look kind of at the scale of humanity, how long humans have been walking this earth, is often said, you know, there's so many other things that we worry about, but we still have to eat 3, 4, 5 times a day, at least once a day, hopefully. But if you are not making your own food, if you're not, you know, at least partially making your own food, you are going to be disconnected from where that food comes from. There is something intrinsically human about collecting, foraging, growing, somehow procuring your own food from the natural state. And I don't mean, you know, just going to the grocery store. But when you actually get that food from a natural state, you get one step closer to understanding that our food and the environment that food is raised is intimately associated with us and our health and our well-being. And if a person ever had the chance to go and see a modern meat poultry facility, they would potentially never eat meat or chicken again. They would do the same thing with any of these confined cattle operations or chicken poultry operations. And we want to turn a blind eye to those things because the alternatives are one of two things, either to become drastic and become a vegetarian or a vegan, which I understand why a lot of people do that, even though I don't completely agree with that lifestyle, or we want to just stick our head in the sand and then we don't question it at all. The alternative, I think, in my opinion, is to become very informed about where our food comes from, about how the food is raised, about the health qualities of that food, and how we end up preparing that food to make something that's not only tasty, but something that's healthful for us. And so people don't want to go to that much work. They don't want to go to that much trouble to learn how to prepare food. And so we end up, as I said before, at the mercy of the people who are preparing the food, the people who are working at the canning factory, the people who are working at the microwave meal plant, these foods, or at the restaurant. And for some of us, you know, if you're kind of got that really outgoing, obnoxious personality, you can kind of tell the chef exactly what you need and how you need it, and you're not going to accept anything less than that. But most of us actually do have a little bit of a modicum of decency, and we want to try to be nice to each other, and we feel bad when we keep asking somebody to change something, even if we know that we can't handle a certain food or we know it's not healthy for us. And so it's more trouble than it's worth, and so we back off from it and we don't want to trouble another person, so we just take what we can get, and then a lot of times that is just not very healthy for us.
Can we take that idea of reconnecting with our food and cooking from our home to lead into your articles? I took you away from that there a few minutes ago, but I do want to take us in that direction. Could you go ahead then?
I am classically known for tangents, and so it definitely keep me on track if I start to get off off task. The biggest thing that I see, I've got a kind of this regular spiel that I go through with my patients about eating. And so many times a person goes to they say, you know what? Hey, you know what? It's the New Year's. I want to get healthy. I'm going to make a New Year's resolution to lose 20 pounds. And they say, okay, how do I do this? And they go to the bookstore, they get online, and they are immediately overwhelmed with all this information. And they say, I don't have a clue what I'm supposed to do. You know, they just kind of put a hand over their eyes and the other hand, they just start reaching whatever book they grab. That's what they're going to use. Or they have another friend who seems to be like they're in good shape and they say, what did you do? And they go and they follow that. They try to get online. They try to read all these research articles and they end up getting bogged down with so much information that they are, you know, they get the analysis paralysis, or they take information that just doesn't even seem to make sense. And so what I tell my patients is, forget all that stuff. Forget what the latest research article shows, whatever TV show that you were watching that said you should eat this or that. Throw all that stuff out the window. And unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to look at it, forget what your doctor says. Forget what anybody else says. Let's just go back in history. Let's just look back and see, how were people designed to eat? If you are a evolutionist, how did humans evolve to eat, say, 50,000, 10,000 years ago? If you're a creationist, how were people eating 10,000 years ago when, you know, they were brought to the earth? How, depending on whatever your worldview is, if you go back 10,000 years, you're going to be good. People ate food. They ate things that they could tolerate. They ate things that were healthy for them. and they ate things that were around at that time. And before I get into the specific details, I should say that people often ask, okay, what am I supposed to weigh? Where is my weight supposed to be? And they look at the BMI, and the BMI is body mass index, and they say that that is a, they don't like it because they say, you know, I'm a big bone person. I don't really fit with the BMI index. What should I weigh? And I say, you know, BMI is not great. I have some people that I see, you know, military patients of mine that are just huge. They've got tons of muscle. For those patients, BMI does not work. For the most part, BMI is a pretty good gauge of where we should be. So that is a goal to set for ourselves. Then the next thing we should look at is calories. We have to understand, you know, I always tell people, you're not going to be that person that breaks the law of thermodynamics, which is energy can only change form. It can't appear or reappear out of nowhere. And so I have a lot of people who try to tell me, Doc, I've been eating nothing and I've been gaining weight. Well, that's not possible. And so people are gaining weight usually through what they eat. You can only gain weight through food, and you can only lose weight through one of two things. You can lose weight through exercise and through something we call a basal metabolic rate, which is your metabolism. Some people have a really high metabolism. A lot of people on my wife's side of the family are tall and thin, and they can eat whatever they want. And those people drive me crazy because they can eat anything and they never gain weight. Now, the inside of their body is probably not as healthy as it should be, but on the outside, they actually are doing pretty good. Then the other half, or I should say a lot more than half of the people, are people like me who, you know, if I really wanted to, I could gain 10 pounds in a week. They have a very low basal metabolic rate. Now, if you get to either extreme, too high or too low, then you've got usually a thyroid problem. But the vast majority of people do not have a thyroid problem. And so it is kind of all about calories. We have to look at your calories in being equal to your calories out to stay the same weight. If you want to lose weight, you have to burn more calories or you have to take in less calories. Now, burning calories to lose weight is not very feasible unless you are going to be exercising at the level of a super athlete, a triathlete, a marathoner. It takes a lot of energy to burn a pound of weight. There is roughly 3,500 calories in a pound. That number, depending on which science article you read, is not entirely accurate, but it's a pretty good gauge for you to see where or how many calories you need to burn to lose a pound of weight. That's a lot of time on a treadmill. That's a lot of time running outside to burn 3,500 calories. It's way easier to change your diet, to change what it is that you are taking into your system than it is to burn off more and more and more. So then people ask, hey, should I count calories? And I never, ever recommend that people count calories. That takes the joy out of eating. I always tell people we have taste buds for a reason. It's to enjoy our food. If we are looking at food only as fuel, we're never going to be able to stick with a diet. Some people can do that. They've got these iron will, you know, this personality that can just decide to do something and to do it. And if they get switched on about, you know, losing weight, they can just, you know, nibble a little something every day until they get down to where they're supposed to be. And then that's it. But there's a lot more to health, as I keep saying, than just their weight. And so we know that exercise doesn't necessarily help you lose weight. Now, exercise is fantastic for our bodies, and I don't want ever to give the impression that I don't recommend exercising. Exercising is great for our bones. It's great for our muscles. It's great for our mental health. It's great for our GI health. There's a lot of things that it improves or reduces the risk of disease for. But I personally don't think going to the gym is necessarily the ideal situation. Again, if we go back 10,000 to 50,000 years ago, humans were not going to the gym. There's no, you know, a tribal group around that were sitting there running in place or doing push-ups or just grabbing weights and lifting them over and over and over again. They did functional fitness, and I actually know there's a few people that are out there promoting this idea, and I've just started to stumble across those practitioners. But the idea is that we should be doing things every single day that is exercise. We should not be living sedentary lives. A lot of us do. I have for years, and I'm trying to get out of that rut. And so sometimes I do have to kind of make up for it with going to the gym, but my goal is to completely cut that part out, because that's not really the way humans were designed. We weren't designed to literally be on a hamster wheel. So exercise is not the key to weight loss. Counting calories is not the key to weight loss. We have to understand the difference between eating healthy and eating to lose weight. We can, as I said before, eat very unhealthy food and lose weight. We can also eat very healthy food and not lose weight. And so the idea is to get ourselves down to a good, healthy weight. And once we get to that weight, maintain that weight by eating healthy. If we want to eat healthy, we want to eat foods that the human body was designed to eat. Going back in time, we saw that most humans were hunter-gatherers. And so they ate meat when they could. They ate fat when they could. They ate vegetables as much as possible. They ate fruit in season. They ate some nuts in season. They ate some tubers in season occasionally. They did eat some grains, but very little. They ate mushrooms when they could, but they did not eat processed foods. They did not eat microwaved foods. They did not eat anything in the frozen food section, really, other than maybe some of the vegetables that were there. And they really did not eat very much grain. I do think, just as you know, you've dealt with yourself with the celiac disease, which if people are not familiar with, is an inability to process gluten. And there's a lot of people who have gluten insensitivity, and then there are people who have celiac disease. I think there's a ton of people who have gluten insensitivity who do not know it. And part of this issue is that grains really are not that healthy for us. They have a lot of nutrients in them, but a lot of those nutrients cannot be absorbed very well. A lot of those, a lot of the grains and many legumes as well actually have anti-nutrients in them that block the absorption of good nutrients that are within that kernel or that seed. And so the biggest recommendation that I've made to people is to cut grains as much out of our diet as possible. Now, there's a big study that was done, the China diet or the China study, that initially showed all this information about why we should be eating rice and how grains are has sustained that population. There has been since subsequent studies, the follow-up China studies or China 2 study, that has shown that, you know, those traditional Chinese cultures ate a lot more meat, ate a lot more fat, and a lot less grains than they were initially thought that was published in that first study. But again, I keep falling back to this idea of quoting studies. And as Mark Twain said, you know, there's lies, damned lies, and statistics. And you can make any study say whatever you want it to say. So this is why I say, forget all this stuff and just use common sense. What were humans eating way back then? Now, it is very possible for a person to eat that type of food and to gain weight if all you ate was fat. You know, you can actually be very unhealthy and eat that way. You can be very unhealthy and lose weight as well, as we talked about before. Now, if we can cut out grains from our diet, we can cut out processed foods from our diet, then we're left with eating fruits, vegetables, nuts, mushrooms, fats, and meats. And the problem that most people run into is that modern raised meat is extremely unhealthy for us. Thankfully, there's been a lot of very good information that has come out in recent years, that shows that the grains that are fed to cattle or to pigs or to whatever animal that you're trying to raise are not healthy for them. Just the same way that humans were not designed really to eat a lot of grains, these animals were not designed to eat a lot of grains. You never see some sort of wild cow, whether it's a bison or a wildebeest or something like that, that is out there eating grains. Now, they will, but they're eating grass. They're pasture-raised, pasture-fed, pasture-finished animals living on savannas or grasslands. That's the way those animals were designed. And so I recommend that people eat animals that were raised in a way that they were designed to live. The meat from those animals is very healthy. The protein is very good. But the fat from those animals is very different than the fat from our modern raised meat. The fat in our modern raised meat is very high in omega-6 fatty acids, which we need a little bit more from omega-6 than we need omega-3, but the proportions are way off. When you eat pasture-finished meat, that meat, or the fat from that meat, has much higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids. In fact, it's the perfect ratio of omega-6 to omega-3. Another fatty acid, the conjugated linoleic acid, which is extremely heart healthy, good for our blood vessels, is very high in that fat as well. And so our great-grandparents, our great-great-grandparents, or depending on how old you are, who used to eat lard, that food was actually kind of a healthy food for them. Nowadays, if we got lard, which is rendered fat from pigs, that would be extremely unhealthy for us. That would be clogging our arteries, which is why, 20 years or so ago, everybody jumped on this low-fat, no-fat bandwagon. And there's still some holdouts that are holding on to this, get rid of the fat, low-fat this, you know, cut all the fat off your meat. Well, if you're eating modern raised meat, then yes, I do recommend cutting the fat off of that meat, trying to get lean cuts of meat if it's all modern raised, and then adding back some good fats like olive oil, coconut oil. But if you have the option, the ability to find pasture-raised meats, or even to grow your own, raise your own, then eat the fat. That fat is going to be very healthy for us. And so it's sometimes tough to find that meat, or sometimes it's expensive to find to eat that meat. And so the reality is also, we probably eat way more meat than we should. Again, I'm not a vegetarian, but we should be eating mostly, or a large chunk of our food. It's fine to be eating almost a vegetarian diet, and we should definitely incorporate the protein and the fat from pasture-raised animals. I think that, I know that the vast majority of pasture-raised animals are raised in a way that is extremely humane and cares about the animal's well-being and their welfare, whereas the factory-raised meat, chicken, eggs, that meat is not. And so the people that have ethical issues with eating products from those animals, I completely understand and I don't disagree. From a health perspective, I think that there's a lot of information that is available that would show you that comparing a vegetarian lifestyle to a modern American diet, a vegetarian lifestyle or a vegan lifestyle is going to be, hands down, is going to be healthier. If you compare a vegan lifestyle or a vegetarian lifestyle to a person who is eating pasture-raised meats and fats and foods that are raised without pesticides, without chemicals, all sprayed on them, those people are going to be much healthier in general than the vegetarians. And I know I always get a lot of flack about that, but the problem is that there's just not been very good studies that have been comparing those two groups, because that second group, this group that's going to be eating basically what the way a permaculturist would eat, there's just not that many of us out there yet. Thankfully, that number is growing and growing. So then the big question is how do I lose weight? How do I try to get down to a healthy weight if I'm eating healthy? Because you can eat a lot of pasture-raised meat with fat in it that's all marbled through it, that's very healthy for us. It's actually very heart healthy for us, but it's got a lot of calories. And so the key is, if you're trying to drop the pounds to get down to a healthy weight, which the vast majority of Americans need to do that, if we want to get down to a healthy weight, how do we do it in a healthy manner? And the key is something that I call energy density. And it's not me that calls it that. It's a common term. But energy density is the idea that there is a lot of calories packed into a small space. And so I often use the example of the meat from a double Whopper from Burger King has about 400 or so calories. Now, the two patties from a double Whopper is about 400 calories. I can easily eat a double Whopper with the bun, with everything else, with the fries and a drink if I wanted to, and take in close to 2,000 calories and be very unhealthy. And if I just ate the meat, I would not be very full, but I took in 400 calories. Now, if you compare that to iceberg lettuce, it would take about 9 heads of lettuce to equal the amount of calories in just 2 meat patties from a Whopper. Now, there's no way on earth I could eat 9 heads of lettuce. Maybe 1 head of lettuce if it was, smashed up, chopped up really fine and I could get it down really quick or something. But, you know, one whole head of lettuce is just 53 calories. So again, I'm not advocating counting calories, but I'm advocating choosing foods that have a lot of space, a lot of volume for low calories. That's low energy density foods. If we eat foods with low energy density, we're going to feel full, but we're going to lose weight. And you can choose, make a lot of very good, healthy choices in the fruits and vegetable realms that have low energy density. In fact, most foods that are fruits and vegetables have low energy density. It's when you get to the meats and the fats that have high energy density. So if you're trying to lose weight, cut back a little bit on your meat, cut back on your fats. You still need some protein and you still need some fat for sure. Cut back on the dried fruits. Cut back on the avocados. Cut back on the, you know, coconut milk. The things that are going to be high in calories for the low volume. Cut back on the nuts and focus on more fruit, fresh fruits and vegetables. You will lose the weight. Now, the other thing that I've seen, and now I should say this, and I should have said this probably from the beginning. I've had a lot of my patients do this, eat this way, and by and large, not by and large, without exception, I should say, every single person who is actually committed to doing this loses weight. And I always say they lose weight as a side effect of eating this way. They end up feeling better. They have more energy. They sleep better. They get sick less often. I've had patients who have had migraines, who their migraines have gone away. I've had patients who have had GI problems, gastrointestinal problems, and they've gone away. Irritable bowel syndrome has completely gone away. I've had patients that have had, you know, some depression type symptoms that have completely gone away. I've had patients that have chronic pain problems. And while those chronic pain problems, autoimmune problems, fibromyalgia, while those symptoms have not completely gone away, the amount of pain medicine that they use has easily been cut in half, sometimes less. And so this is not some idea that I'm just a genius and I figured out. There's so much information that has been supporting this and that has been really blossoming over the last few years. Some of it has been going under the guise of the paleo diet. Some of it has been really been propagated by the work put out by the Weston A. Price Foundation. And so this information is out there. It's easily accessible. It works. You feel better. And for me, as a permaculturist, there's the added benefit of when you are raising food in a way that is building the soil, that is truly caring for the land. And when I say the land, I actually mean the animals as well. But when you are actually putting the land, the animals and plants, and raising them in a way that they were designed to be raised with a lot of diversity, you end up needing a lot less work to raise these animals. But the animals and plants are significantly happier. They don't need all the antibiotics. They don't need the herbicides and the pesticides and all the chemicals that are sprayed on them. And so with the soil being richer and more alive, or actually being alive, you end up with plants that are more nutrient dense. And this is different than energy density. Nutrient density means that you're gonna have a lot more these things that we just don't quite understand entirely, but these things that we call phytonutrients, these chemicals that the plants produce as normal defense mechanisms, normal antibiotics, normal antioxidants that are just truly medicine for our body. And when we are raising food or eating food from land that is raised following permaculture principles, we end up truly eating food that is our medicine and letting medicine be our food. Kind of bringing it all the way back around to the beginning again with what I believe Hippocrates' goal was to really be active in our own health and not just look to other people for all the solutions.
I do have one question about what you were saying earlier regarding protein. Mm-hmm. I've heard everywhere from, what is it, a quarter of a gram of protein per pound of body weight up to as much as 1.5 grams of protein per day per pound of body weight. The numbers are all over the place. Do you have any insight into that? Or is it one of those, because you're asking people not to count calories, that's not something you really necessarily count either?
I am kind of laughing because the first point is I have no idea. And I'll be very frank and honest about that. The thing is that all these people who claim to know, I don't think they know either. I think you can take whatever data you want, and as I said before, you can make it say whatever you want it to say. I think the most important thing is to become more in tune with our body. I truly and firmly believe that there is not one right answer for every single person. Every single person has different physiology. We've got different genetics. Some people can handle wheat, gluten just fine. And I think you can do that in moderation if your body allows it. Some people, you cannot have any gluten at all or else you'll be miserable. Some people, the majority of the world is lactose intolerant. There are some people who can eat lots of lactose or lots of milk and dairy products and have no problem whatsoever. And then there's some people who are kind of in between. They can eat a little bit of cheese. They can eat some hard cheese and they're fine. If they drink milk, then they get sick. And so there's not one prescription for every single person. You know, the classic permaculture answer to every question starts off with, it depends. And so I look at animals and I say, you know what? You put out a mix of minerals or individual minerals in feed bins for cattle. They will go out there and they will eat just the mineral that they need and just as much as they need. And then they leave it alone. You can put a salt lick out and they will leave that thing alone for a long time and then they'll come back to it and devour it. Or pigs will go out into a pasture and they will find a rift or a seam of clay that has a certain mineral that their bodies need, and they will eat that clay like crazy and then they'll just stop. And animals have this ability to identify the minerals and the nutrients that they need. I think humans have lost that. I don't think we can relearn it the way that animals can, but I think we can become much more in tune with what we're supposed to be doing. And so my recommendation when anybody asks me a question like this, and I do get that question a lot, how much of this should I eat or how much of that should I eat? Like, can you give me a number? And my answer is no, I really can't. What you need to do is find out where you kind of hit that sweet spot. If eating, you know, a half a gram per body weight or what your ideal body weight is doesn't quite feel right, maybe bump it up a little bit. And if you're eating a little too much and you're just, wow, I just kind of feel a little bloated and man, I don't feel like I feel quite right. Cut it back a little bit and see. And now the idea behind these series of articles was to give a general guideline. And then the individual person really has to start applying it to their lives and seeing how it works for them. And so I'm not trying to be elusive in answering that, but it truly does just depend.
I wanted to ask your opinion on that because of all the information that was out there. And because part of my personal story with coming to understand my own diet and things was just that I've been kind of listening to myself when I eat and I feel better for it. And it took me a long time because of some of the, if you will, uncaring medical professionals that I've encountered at times. It becomes almost as if listening to oneself and one's own body is not the right thing to do, that there's this level of expertise when you go talk to your doctor, they're telling you these things, that's the way that you should do things.
You know, let me also say this. There's a number of things like just what you're saying. Oh, you're smoking. If you would just stop smoking, everything would be better. You know, oh, you're overweight. If you would lose weight, everything would be better. And the reality is that's not true. Do I think smoking is not a good idea for your health? Yes. Do I think that every single person who smokes is going to die a horrible death of cancer? No, the reality is they're not. Now, we have to make good health choices, but the one big glaring thing often distracts ourselves and distracts your healthcare provider from getting to the underlying root. And the underlying root is trying to become more healthy and trying to listen to our bodies. There's so many facets of health, as we've been talking about throughout this last hour, is that we cannot focus on just one aspect or else we're going to accomplish that and then we're going to get frustrated because everything else is not working. You know, we lost the weight, but now we don't feel good still because, well, you lost the weight by starving yourself and now your body doesn't know what to do anymore. The reality is I've had a number of patients, not many, but a few, who start to eat this way and gain weight. And I'll tell you why. especially when they start eating the pasture-fed meats and they switch over to like organic food. Organic food, and there's actually been a number of studies that have shown that organic food is not any more nutrient-dense than conventionally grown foods. And I actually completely agree with that. In part, if you look at large organic food producers, from the outside, they almost look identical to the traditionally or the modern agricultural or big ag system of raising food. They just don't spray the chemicals. So yeah, that is way healthier. I think not exposing ourselves to all these chemicals and toxins is way healthier. But it's not necessarily going to make this food any more nutrient dense. It's raising this food in soil that is high quality that ends up creating food that has more nutrients in them. So much of the problem that we have with obesity in the United States is because we're eating food that is so nutritionally poor. It's calorie dense, but it has so few nutrients that our body is just craving nutrients. And so we eat it and we say, oh, it only had, you know, 5% of the nutrients that I need, even though I had already have 100% of the calories that I needed for the day. Are the nutrient drive outweighs the caloric drive. And so we end up taking in more calories to try to find these nutrients that we need. And so we eat and eat and eat and eat unhealthy food. So we are a population of overweight but malnourished people. And so when people suddenly switch or suddenly, unsuddenly, make the transition to nutrient-dense foods, their body suddenly says, this is what I've been craving for so long. And they start listening to their body and they will eat and eat and eat. And the next thing they know, they say, wow, like that was a whole roast. And I just split that with my family. We usually used to have a lot of leftovers. Now we have no leftovers. And I just took thirds and I didn't realize it. It's because their body is getting all these nutrients again. That may last for a month or two. And then their body kind of tops off, realizes, hey, this isn't going anywhere. You know, I'm going to have access to this. This is great. I'm kind of getting a lot of these nutrients that I didn't quite realize I was missing. And then all of a sudden the weight just drops off. I had an elderly couple, I diagnosed both of them with high blood pressure and diabetes 1 week apart from each other. And they were both smokers and they were just so unhealthy. He was actually a tugboat captain. And they decided, you know what? We don't want to be in all these medicines that are, you know, potentially going to prolong our life with the potential risk of all these side effects from these medications. And so I said, look, we've got really two options or three options. You can do nothing and get worse and die from these problems, complications from them. You can go the traditional route, which is, or the more modern medical route, which is to take all these medications, which will put a Band-Aid on the problem. And you can continue eating and living the exact same way that you do. And you'll feel good about not being quite so sick, but the underlying problem is still there. Or you can get to the root of the problem and actually change your lifestyle. And within about, I think it was about 6 or 7 months, they had together lost about 150 pounds. I mean, it was like, boom. And they no longer had high blood pressure or diabetes. They had both stopped smoking. And they were sleeping better and feeling better. And they were, I'm like, if I could clone you with every single one of my patients, it would be amazing. You are my poster children for what we should be doing as a country. And I talk about them a lot because if we could get turned on like that and really make a change, we have the ability to kind of turn around our health.
There's a line that Mark Lakeman had about whose story do you want to inhabit? And I think about how that reflects on our own lives and taking responsibility for ourselves and listening to our own stories, the lessons that our body can teach us, that our friends can share with us, our doctors, if they're good and we trust them, the conversations we can have and the dialogues to move our life forward in a way that's meaningful to us and not to continue listening to what someone else has to say is correct or incorrect, or we should do or shouldn't do, but to work cooperatively with others to find out our own right path forward. Mm-hmm. I have one other kind of like on the ground question about protein. Not to go back to parsing how many grams of this or how many grams of that, but as you said, it's eating meat, it's pasture raised in that way, can be a bit more expensive. I already look at, you know, what grocery store prices are versus buying pasture-raised meat from my local farmer's market. The price is coming down considerably, but it can still be three times as much per pound in some cases. What about eggs that are free-range? I've seen some eggs advertised as having a better omega-3 versus omega-6 fatty acid ratio. Would that be an appropriate source of protein?
Well, first of all, I think eggs are a great food. If you look back kind of through medical literature, you know, one year eggs are bad, the next year eggs are good, and the next year eggs are bad, the next year they're good again. And so, again, people ate eggs and have eaten eggs, wild bird eggs, domesticated poultry eggs for a long, long, long time. It is a very good food source for us. Again, it depends on how the bird and the animals are raised. There is very poor legal requirements describing how eggs can be labeled, you know, free range, pasture raised, other than organic. There's actually some very tight stipulations on that. But the free range, they can have a window or a little door that leads them to a little grass pasture. But those chickens never go outside because they're scared to death of it, because they've lived their entire life inside this, you know, dark warehouse type facility. That can be qualified as pasture or as free range because they have the ability to walk out there if they want to. And so my personal opinion is that we should get to know our food producers. We should go out and find out who's raising our food and how they're raising them. That's not always easy. That's another project that I have been working on, is to create a website with some other people as well to help make that process a lot easier. And that may be something that we can talk about a little bit later on when that project comes to fruition. But going out and finding how your food is raised and getting to know the people who raise your food is, I think, very important. It connects you again in a social way, which is important. It gets you more closely associated with the land. But to answer your question, to be fair, I would choose those eggs over the traditional eggs. I would choose organic eggs over pretty much all the others, just because of all the other chemicals that can be put on them. I'm a big fan of eggs. If you have the ability to raise your own, get, you know, three or five hens, that is the ideal. Then you know exactly how your hens are being raised and how the eggs are being produced.
And that's one. I know there's a lot of push often in the conversations about permaculture for everybody to go, you know, start your own garden, get your own chickens, raise all your own food. But that doesn't fit for everyone. And that whole, you know, it depends kind of model that is emerging as a regular kind of reminder of all this is, if you can't grow your own, it's, you know, you have a black thumb, you're not good at it, or for whatever other reason, go to your farmer's market, meet your farmers, find out how they grow and produce things, get to know them. It's one of the stories that I tell often when I'm talking with people about this is, I go to my farmer's market and the guy I buy my fruit from, I've met his four daughters and his wife and his mother-in-law, and I know that everything that I purchase from them is going to put those girls through school if they choose to, is going to pay for the roof over their head and be directly used by someone in my community to do good.
It's so much more fun to get to know the people who raise your food. I get my eggs from an old German couple who just basically got turned off by all the modern chemicals, and they just raise their own food, and they supply me, you know, a dozen eggs a week. And it takes me a lot longer to get my eggs from them than it does from going, you know, just running to the grocery store. But I've built a relationship there, and I've got trust, and I know how that food is raised. I know that when I give it to my kids, I don't have to be concerned that there might be, you know, some sort of chemical that's sprayed on it. I know that food is going to be something that's healthful, building health for them instead of sabotaging it.
And then we get to help raise another generation of healthy, productive kids. I love the difference we can make in the world by connecting with others and helping them on their own path in the way that it helps us on our own. And from this conversation, I think that we've covered everything that I wanted to. Before we bring things to a close, John, do you have anything else to share with the listeners?
Get connected with your food. It is so important to go out at the bare minimum. Know where your food is coming from. Become food aware. Start looking into it at least. If you can start to cook some of your own meals, if you're a person who doesn't cook at all, start to experiment, start to try. There's a really good chance that you will start to learn to like it. And if not, find out where your food is coming from. Get to know your farmers, get to know the people who are raising your food. It is so important for your health to become connected with your food source again. Modern medicine will help prolong life to a certain point, but it will not help you live a super healthy, enjoyable, vibrant life. That falls into your hands. And the other thing would be just learn to listen to your body. Your body has got some very intelligence that we have to start learning to listen to again.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kitzsteiner, for your time with us today, for your perspective on broad holistic health from the position as an MD. Well, I have a lot of respect for that because in many ways I feel that Western medicine saved my life by finding the right doctors and the people who cared. And I'm glad to hear that there are other people out there helping people kind of demystify this process of health and what it means to take care of our body, our mind, our spirit, and to eat well and be healthy. So thank you very much for all of your work, for being a permaculture practitioner, and your time with me today.
Thank you for your time. Scott, I appreciate the stuff that you're doing there at the Permaculture Podcast. Keep up the good work.
And that was Dr. Kitzsteiner. Again, if you'd like to get in touch with him, his blog is tcpermaculture.com. And if you live in a temperate climate, man, it's a good one. And from the conversation that he and I had, it reminds me of some of my favorite temperate climate permaculture books, especially for the Eastern Woodlands. The first of those is Patrick Whitefield's Earth Care Manual. I think it's probably my favorite just straight up permaculture manual. It makes me think of Mollison's Designer's Manual, but in a more enjoyable and easier to read format. Though, I will admit, Mollison's Designer's Manual is still the place to go to. It's encyclopedic, but things have changed a lot since it was originally released. One of my other favorite books for a temperate or eastern climate is the 2-volume series from Dave Jackie and Eric Tonesmeyer, Edible Forest Gardens. It's really, really worth the price. I know that it's not cheap by any regard, but if I were going to buy only one set of permaculture books, that would be probably the ones that I would get, at least in the environment where I live. Another book that I really love is also Masanobu Fukuoka's The One Straw Revolution, because of the philosophy that it shares with us. That's probably the first place that I think anybody should start reading when it comes to the foundational materials for permaculture. Get that philosophy and personal perspective before exploring these other books that are more about on-the-ground techniques intermixed with the philosophy. Oh, and for temperate climates, I also should include Ben Falk and The Resilient Farm and Homestead. I really enjoyed that book. The first third laid a lot of design material on you, but then kind of really pays off in the last two thirds when he starts giving you the examples of what they're building there. And that book, along with the work of Bob Tice, really changed the way that I looked at renovating my own home. And that conversation about my home renovations, and then to also break down some of the costs with you, will be some of the upcoming permaculture shorts, which we're still working on a name for. For those of you who haven't heard about it, I'm looking to supplement these longer weekly interviews with shorter pieces, something that's unscripted, less structured. I just kind of sit down with an idea and use the mic, record it, and share it with you, with the intention being that those are going to be 15 minutes or less, something that you could listen to while planting a single tree, maybe harvesting some greens and fruit for your evening salad, or, you know, washing the dishes after that meal, so you don't have to settle in and take in this long hour plus episode. However, I'm going to keep doing the interviews so that you have these bigger pieces that you can settle into if you happen to have a long car ride or commute. Things are still being worked out with where the show will go, but it looks like that path is getting a little bit brighter with each passing day. Thank you, everyone, who's been part of that. All right, so other than that, from here, on March 8th, I'm going to be at the A Gathering of Farmers conference. I'll be presenting a workshop on Permaculture 101. And because my format for something like a lecture or presentation is the idea of 15 minutes and then Q&A, it should be pretty interesting to have this dialogue and discussion with the farmers and other folks who are in attendance. I have up to, I believe, an hour and a half for the workshop from what was given to me, but I'm looking to do an hour that's structured and break that down to like a half an hour lecture and then a 30-minute Q&A, but then, if possible, to remain in the room where the lecture is occurring in order to continue to field questions for anybody who's interested up for that full hour and a half. At that event, I will also have my friend and photographer John Staley with me to record the event with his photonic weapons of mass documentation, the giant cameras he carries around. So if you see a guy with glasses and two crazy looking cameras, mustache and a beard, that's probably John taking pictures. You'll also see me floating around him from time to time as the event allows. We're going to try to see if we can shoot some video while we're there. From there, next week is going to be Wayne Herring. I think that conversation with Wayne is going to be really useful in kind of collaboration with this one from John Kitzsteiner, because of the way that it ties together how small-scale family farmers are doing their work and what it's like to invest in another person and the work that they're doing, especially when it comes to these small farms that are working to be regenerative enterprises. And I think that will draw this episode to a close. Thank you for joining me again for another episode of the Permaculture Podcast. Thank you for choosing to spend your time with me and really help to build a better world. Together, we can make all the difference that's needed. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.